dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And this we go.
You're listening to episode 547 of Unwelcome Guests. Outing Prison, Part 2. I'm Robin Upton. This week on the show, we continue our investigation into prison, following up from our earlier one about its hidden racial aspects. And we've got two parts to this episode. Firstly, a look at fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, a particular brain deficiency which is caused by mothers drinking alcohol during pregnancy, which results in the babies born having what lawyer David Boulding says is 75 to 85% chance of going to jail. So these people are effectively being punished for being disabled. Now, with that concrete example in mind of how prison is disadvantaging some of society's most vulnerable, if troublesome members, who for no fault of their own are lacking an ability to succeed well in mainstream society, we're then going to listen to Vivian Stern, long-time prison reformer and member of the UK House of Lords, speaking about what prison has become in the UK. The larger picture we'll be developing at the end of the show, with the help of a section from Charles Eisenstein's Ascent of Humanity, Life Under Contract, about how prisons and laws spring from the attempt to control everything, the attempt of centralized hierarchy to define what may happen and what may not happen. Now, thanks to the Stark Raven Media Collective at www.prisonjustice.ca for this interview from 2010.
It is becoming clearer. Prisons are where a lot of people living with fetal alcohol spectrum disorder are ending up. And prison is the last place they should be to find the support and interventions that they need. Here to help us explore FASD, fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, and its relationship to the criminal justice system is Vancouver lawyer David Boulding. David is an advocate and educator on fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. He came to this after many years of making some mistakes working with clients in the system who had FASD, and prompted to him in the past decade to do dozens of workshops, presentations, and written papers on the issue. And David joins us in the studio. Thanks for joining us, David.
I'm glad to be here.
So I've heard several different terms when we're referring to fetal alcohol, FASD, FASE, FAS. What's the difference in these terms?
The term fetal alcohol spectrum disorder is an umbrella term. It's not a diagnosis. Inside the umbrella are a number of discrete neurological and neurobehavioral diagnoses, and there's a spectrum of them, and they all have different characteristics and severity.
So what is fetal alcohol spectrum disorder?
It's very simple. It's a brain-based birth defect. Mom drinks alcohol. Alcohol is a solvent like nail polish remover, and the alcohol dissolves the baby's brain cells in the womb, and the baby is born missing body parts. They happen to be brain cells. They're not coming back, and so the baby comes into the world with a disability, not unlike somebody who's missing an arm or a leg.
And how common is this?
That's a million-dollar question. There's one piece of peer-reviewed science in the world, done in Canada, done in British Columbia, actually, that came back at, in our youth custody system, it was about 24 to 40%. Population studies around the world are coming back at 1 to 4% in different kinds of populations. The really bad news is that the people who run the federal prisons, that's 2 years in jail, are very quietly doing their own studies, and their prison populations are coming back at 50 to 80% of the people in our federal prisons have one of the diagnoses.
So that's a really high percentage inside the prison system. What about outside? How does that compare to the number of people, say, just in the general community who are affected by FASD?
I would have to, if you really want the statistics, you go to the FADU website in Seattle, the works of Anne Streisguth, and she's got all this information. But essentially, if you've got fetal alcohol, 75 to 85% chance you're going to jail.
Right. So if you're living with FASD, what does that mean for you? What are some of your challenges?
Attention, learning, adaptive behaviors, reasoning, memory, impulse control, concentration, understanding the difference between value and number. How much is this car worth? I'll give you $300. Okay, when it's worth $5,000. It's a number value thing. The main reason, here's a quick way of looking at it. Emily, you and I are never going to be arrested, and we're never going to go to jail for two reasons. The first reason is you and I have friends. Something happens, it's, Emily, get back in the car. It's not worth it. Get back in the car. Second reason is, Emily, you and I have a voice in the back of the head that says, Emily, you're being really stupid. Get back in the car, da-da-da-da-da. People with fetal alcohol, as a rule, don't have friends because their behaviors, quite bluntly, piss everybody off. They just push people away. But the more common reason is that voice in the back of your head, that's a higher brain function. That's that, you know, conscience, that's that fine frontal lobe skills acting up. They don't have that. They literally don't have the brakes on social control. And on the other side of the equation, they often don't get sarcasm, don't understand puns, don't understand social situations. Sometimes they miss social cues. Sometimes they can be very literal and very, very, you know, constructive in their language. If they can't put their hands on it and count it, they don't get it.
So this term or this identification of fetal alcohol spectrum disorder is pretty new.
Yes and no. Aristotle talks about it. It's in the Bible, the Old Testament. We have lots of evidence through history about it. It became a clinical diagnosis in the 60s, became known to the world in the early 80s when it was a big article by two fellows in Seattle was published in Nature. So it's been around as a known medical diagnosis for since about the 80s, but it's largely unknown, I think, for a couple of reasons. And one of the reasons is most people in the business of brains and brain problems are psychiatrists, and they live in the world of the DSM-4. Fetal alcohol is not in the DSM-4, and it's not going to be in the DSM-5.
The DSM, what's that?
That's the big silver book of mental illnesses. It's all codified. It's an arbitrary division of symptoms. If you have this symptom and two of these things and two of that, then you're...
You have bipolar disorder.
Then you've got
whatever.
Bipolar. And so the DSM-4 was an attempt, and it's a good idea, to make sure that people doing the diagnosis were on the same, singing from the same hymn sheet. But because it's based on symptoms, in other words, what I see and the behaviors you have, it's often not helpful. Fetal alcohol is what it is. Mom was drinking. Missing brain cells, and there's no cure, there's no fix. All the probation orders in the world, the time in jail, all the therapy, all the drugs in the world you want to give somebody, they're not going to regrow those brain cells. So we have a real problem because, my opinion, that often people in the business, they need a label to sort of process the person through a system. Bipolar, there's a good label. So we do the kinds of things we do for bipolar. I'm not interested in labels. What I want is I want to help people, and to help people, you have to identify how the brain is functioning. You have to see the brain. Ah, this person has real memory problems. Ah, there's just a real problem here with reasoning or learning or attention. There's a specific brain problem. Ah, it's permanent, so what do I have to do? I have to make an accommodation. And the only way I can describe that, it's really simple. Remember all those little holes in the sidewalk we put for the people in wheelchairs?
Like the little ramps.
The little ramps. We have ramps everywhere. That's an accommodation. We need to make those kind of accommodations. And the fetal alcohol intellectual community has a whole bunch of suggestions and a whole bunch of stuff. And it comes down to one simple phrase called the external brain. We need to create a committee of walking, talking people to help with those brain functions that those missing cells need. And it works. Does that help?
Yeah, so you're making a distinction between the symptoms. So someone's acting erratically or is antisocial or has attention problems. Versus that sort of way of labeling or approaching things versus seeing it more as a physical disability of the brain.
Here's how I look at it. They're called primary and secondary problems. The primary problems are those problems that are a result of missing brain cells. Okay? Impulse control, memory problems, reasoning problems. Okay? The secondary problems are the problems as a result of a poor fit. If you have those neurological problems, you don't fit in. You miss appointments. People get angry with you. You break rules. You don't understand things. You get things wrong. You don't do well in school. So the secondary problems, anxiety, frustration, anger, hurt. And another secondary problem is crime. So I'm not that interested in the primary problems because I can't fix those. Mm. I can't bring back the brain cells. But I can do something about the anxiety, the frustration. I can do something about when he gets arrested. Because then that's about the only chance you have is to intervene, because then the state, the government, has a choice. Put the person in prison or spend some money on them. And at the end of the day, most of these people need a good probation officer who can organize a team to help them. Because putting these people in prison is a double-edged sword. You're not going to like this, but prison's not all a bad place for some people. For some of my clients, I know there's victimization, I know it's a horrible place, but for some of my clients, I know they're being fed, I know they got a place to sleep. And that's kind of a horrible trade-off to make.
It's kind of a horrible state about the state of our community to say.
Well, we live in a world where there are two kinds of people. There's the Tommy Douglases, and then there's the Bill Aberharts. There's the people who think we're all in this together and let's try to help each other. And then there's the people who like to blame poor people for being poor, and they think that they're ripping off all us rich people. And at the end of the day, you got to decide, as my friend Jocelyn Palmer says, she's the judge from drug court. She says, you know, David, I have to decide, do I help somebody or do I punish them? And she's one of the people that helps.
So you know, by some of the behaviors that you're describing people living with FASD have, they have more of a chance of ending up in sort of the arms of the criminal justice system. Can you tell us a little bit more about how that happens, how they end up there, and what kind of problems you're seeing as they end up in the criminal justice system?
Most of the people with fetal alcohol, there's a wonderful book by a Vancouver writer called Dennis Boland called Stupid Crimes. Got to read it. He's 35 years as a federal parole officer, and that's what fetal alcohol people do. They appear to be a first or second time offender because it's kind of stupid, like misunderstanding kind of, you know, you do that once or twice and you'd stop. But they do it 37 times. So they come back to the same judge or in the same courthouse, the same thing. And people are tired because, you know, 30 days didn't work, 90 days didn't work, 2 years didn't work, and it's the same kind of nonsense because people don't get it's a permanent brain-based birth defect. If you're in class and you're a math teacher, yelling at the blind kid at the back of the room to look harder at the blackboard is not going to get him to pass calculus. And this is the problem we have to look at. We have to stop, take a deep breath, and say, what's going on with that brain? Because it's not like my brain.
So that's some of the things that you're advocating for. So once someone gets caught up in the system is to teach people, some of the work you do, I imagine, teach people how to identify FASD and then how to better deal with people once they're in the system. What are some of those suggestions or ways that you see are, once someone's in the system, a better way to kind of identify and deal with them?
One of my clients was, two or three pages of criminal record, and he had, you know, mischief problems and stuff like that. But essentially his problem was he would go shopping and things would turn out bad. The lovely young girl on the other side of the counter at the bay, it would just, bad things would happen. You know, things would get knocked over and blouses would be torn. It was like over and over and over again. And one judge finally, at the end of his rope, because he'd been seeing this guy for years, at the end of the day, he just got quite upset and sent him on probation and sent him off to the pound to walk dogs. Turns out the judge knew somebody who was on the board of director for the pounds, and they needed people to walk dogs. So he sent off to the pound to walk dogs. First time in his life. First time in his life. He has uncritical love. Dogs love him. He loves dogs. So he's walking dogs, 9 to 5, 5 days a week. Second thing that happens is the pound has got all these volunteers, and there's nice people that own Volvos. Well, they put two and two together, and they see he's got a few problems. And one of the problems is when he goes shopping, just all his stuff backs up and bad things happen. So one of them says, I'll make sure he gets to his probation appointments, and another couple of older fellers said, I'll take him shopping. Last I saw him. So there's an accommodation and there's an external brain. And that one was done by accident. And what happened there was, is somebody realized it's not the person is bad. The brain is not functioning like your brain and my brain. It's a brain function issue. It's not a character issue. It's not that somehow they didn't do well in manners 101 or social good life, 102. They're missing brain cells.
And I've heard of this external brain sort of thing. Is that what you mean, setting up mechanisms and relationships and sort of a structure that helps people to function, keep them within the boundaries or guidelines they need?
Absolutely. It is a committee of people who stand in for the missing brain functions. You got memory problems? They'll remind you. You have reasoning problems? When you come to some situation and need help, they say, no, your car is not worth $300. Your car is worth $3,000. Oh, big difference. So it's a committee of people that stand in for the missing brain cells.
And that's been proven to work quite well?
Every probation officer in the world will tell you the same story. You give me 5 or 6 kids, they'll never commit another crime. But they have 85 to 100 on their plate. Everybody knows the story of the high school teacher that took the special student under his wing and got him into something, whether, that he was fitting out well. This has been going on for a long time. It's just that the fellow that thought this up, Dr. Claren, made it specific and made it quite a rigorous process. And at the end of the day, it works, because what happens are two things. One, the person, for the first time in his life, has a relationship that's open-ended. Your definition of success gets stretched. He showed up in the right week for his appointment. Celebrate that. And so your definition of success is just expanded. And the second thing is, people in relationship have better lives than people by themselves. You know that. It's called friends. It's called social systems. It's called networking. And these people, because of their missing brain cells, have a poor fit. They are really marginalized.
Is there a pretty wide range of... Is it like a hard thing to identify because there's such wide range?
Yes and no. Just so you know, there are lawyers and psychologists with fetal alcohol. There are lots of people with it. But here's a quick way to identify it. Go over to 222 and go into remand court and just sit there for a couple of days. And after a while, you get a feel in the rhythm of the place. And here's what happened. Prosecutor stands up, reads in a set of facts. Everybody has a laugh. And then you realize it's the 17th or 18th time this person has been arrested for kind of the same thing. And so what you've got is, the laughter is the poor fit. Who would do that? Well, this guy did it over and over again. And so there's the poor fit. There's the repeated behavior. There's the person all by himself for some small crime. That's a quick way, but the really quick way is we teach a course for the RCMP. The RCMP, by the way, are the only police force in the world that have a dedicated course and a dedicated manual on fetal alcohol. It's like world-breaking stuff. And we have this one phrase we teach the RCMP, ALARM, Adaptive Behaviors, Learning, Attention, Reasoning, and Memory. So if you look into those areas and you've got several deficits, then you start to say, whoa, I need to think about fetal alcohol. For example, three years ago, the Law Society, in its criminal checklists that are given to criminal lawyers, began including in one of the questions, consider fetal alcohol. So we're now getting more and more people. The problem is, the billing code is stuck in committee. The psychiatrists want it all, And it's really a multidisciplinary diagnosis with a doctor, a pediatrician, a neurologist, speech and language pathologist, a psychiatric social worker. It's a team thing, and a psychiatrist wants it all, so there's no billing code number. So to get a diagnosis, you have to pay for it, usually through the Asante Center, or what my clients do. I had one client kidnap his children, believe it or not, kidnap his children, take them to Alberta, got a diagnosis. In Alberta, they're free.
Right. So there's a bit of politics in how things are labeled and then how that impacts who gets which services. And
yeah, I'm sure you're surprised by that.
But it does sound like education is a big component of that. People just aren't aware, particularly people working within a system.
That's what
hospitals.
I'm doing. I just came back from 10 days in Iqaluit and Baffin Island. Next week, I'm speaking to the frontline social workers on Seymour Street. And it sounds crazy, but there's that piece on YouTube I tell people to take a look at. After about the first 15 minutes, they all ask the same questions. What can you tell me that's going to make me do my day differently? And there's some things that they need to know, and it's not that difficult.
What are those things?
Well, Diane Mulvan has them written down for you, and they're four simple things. And I'll just read them to you so I don't make it. There they are right here. Identify the brain before you. That talked about what kind of brain is that. Here's the big one. Identify your assumptions. I told you about the assumptions you and I have. You and I, Emily, we're in the middle class. We are, you know. And next thing is you gotta adjust your definition of success. And that's really hard because in the business of being a judge or a lawyer or a probation officer, we had this thing called the criminal code. There's a bunch of stuff just not allowed. Mm. And the last thing we have to do is change their environment. Now, that's a bit unusual because that's two things. The first environment we have to change them is we have to get them out of the patterns where they live. Usually their address and who they get. Because these are the people who are used for drug mules. These are people who are used to help in offenses. But the big environment you have to change is the one in their heart. They need a relationship with the people on this external brain. That is what we need to do.
Sounds like supportive housing would be a really important piece for that.
Well, I go all over the world and I tell people about Portland House for a reason.
What's Portland House?
This one over there. What's it called? Portland?
Oh, the Portland Hotel Society?
Yeah.
Oh, I see.
And I think that's a kind of a model that I think is worth looking at. They have one in Seattle, which is not quite as sophisticated.
And I think people have an image of FASD and the problem of drinking during pregnancy as more of a concern in marginalized communities. is this perception true? Like, how does that...
No.
Well, how does that play itself out in terms of class and community?
Hold on to your crinolines. The people who drink the most while pregnant are white, with more than 4 years university education, that earn 400% above the poverty line. They drink 2 to 3 times as much in the first trimester as women who are poor, marginalized, or women of color. Put it bluntly, rich stockbrokers have wives who drink while they're pregnant. They don't call their kids fetal alcohol, though, do they, Emily?
I guess not, no.
I guess not.
No.
They call them something else.
What do they call them?
Well, what they do then is they have a child with these kinds of issues. They take the child to a psychiatrist or a psychologist who uses a DSM-4. So it's always a diagnosis out of the DSM-4. Antisocial personality, obstructive behavior. There's a whole list of them, but the favorite one is attention deficit.
Interesting. So there's some sort of argument that attention deficit disorder is actually labeling a behavior that comes out from the attention fetal alcohol.
What is most difficult about attention deficit disorder is what's difficult with people with fetal alcohol. Their behaviors make it very difficult for the people close to them. And so one of the things that the DSM-4 offers them is, well, if your child has A, B, and C, this, we have this diagnosis, and there's a medical protocol that they use for attention deficit. But the new research that's out is suggesting that attention deficit is just a facet of fetal alcohol.
Interesting. I've never heard that before. So if we're looking at people who are living in prison who are living with FASD, which, depending on which study, is pretty high percentage, what kind of challenges would they face living inside a jail?
Well, the big one they have in a jail is victimization. There are some very famous stories of people with fetal alcohol phoning their parents up and say, Dad, there's a really nice man in my cell, and he says for $10,000 he'll make sure nothing happens to me. And so you get these kind of calls from my clients. But victimization is one. They get used, as I said. These are your drug mules. These are the people that are the helpers. For example, most of my clients who are arrested, who have fetal alcohol, they're the second or third person involved in the offense. They didn't think it up. They didn't drive it. They certainly didn't get the money, but they certainly did get arrested. So by the time they get to prison, they have real problems with the social cues. But here's, you're not going to like this either. They thrive on structure. These people love structure, repetition structure. And prison offers that. So if they're identified and the people in the prison know about this particular vulnerability, they often do well. Often you get the reports back when you ask for the reports how they're doing in jail, and they're model prisoners. And that's a really ugly thing to say. How can you be a model prisoner? But they like the structure.
So that's something, using that knowledge of that need for structure, a way to apply that in terms of supporting housing or creating this external brain or these relationships in the community before people end up in conflict.
Exactly.
With the
law. What we're looking to do is find ways, and I mean, this is going to sound so crazy, but I'm really angry about this one. In the next couple of weeks, Mr. Campbell and his rich friends are shutting down all the homes for mentally retarded adults and having the people who are responsible for them go find private care for them. We did this 10 years ago. We emptied the mental hospitals, and they all end up down here. And so what we need to do is the opposite. We need to have a whole bunch of what I call halfway houses or group homes, you know, for people with schizophrenia, for people with fetal alcohol, for people with all kinds of problems, because at the end of the day, group homes are financially smart, they're good for the community, and the bottom line is they don't end up down here on your corner, because when you emptied out Riverview, where did they all go? The chief of police 2 years ago is quite angry, and he issued a report. He did a study, and he said 34% of the calls to the Vancouver Police Department aren't criminal. They're mental health problems. And who do you think that is? Those are the people with fetal alcohol. Those are the people with schizophrenia. Those are the people who are mentally marginalized.
So what about the whole politics of prevention? I'm sure there's some people who would say, well, women drink during pregnancy and their kids may end up with fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. What about that whole line of conversation?
Well, I tell people, I just read it to you. It's easier. I've read this before. I think you have to go past judgment and understand the reasons why pregnant women drink. It's difficult. It requires a heartfelt, clear-minded knowledge of family violence, close relationship, poverty, lack of education, addiction, and understanding of how people cope. I've yet to meet a client that was drinking to harm her baby. The biggest single indicator of how much a woman drinks when pregnant is how much does her partner drink. And so at the end of the day, what we have to do is we have to talk about alcohol. A guy in England who's the number two medical officer in England last year lost his job because he said, forget cocaine, forget heroin, forget crack, forget marijuana. Alcohol is the biggest single problem we have in public health addictions. It just dwarfs everything. But no one wants to talk about alcohol because you have the alcohol industry, we have this social veneer that alcohol is a good part to live. But at the end of the day, it's our biggest single drug. It's the drug of human beings, and it has been since Aristotle's time, since the Bible, since the Old Testament. And until we confront this double standard, I'm not talking about prohibition of alcohol. I'm talking about education. Here's something that Toronto did. Every restaurant in the city of Toronto, in the women's restrooms, has a little sign that says, caution, drinking alcohol while pregnant will cause your baby difficulties. How simple is that? And it's not just labeling alcohol bottles, but it's talking to young women who go through these rites of passage. You know, when someone gets married, they get pissed on Thursday night. There's another party on Thursday night. Then they get drunk at the wedding. And there's this idea that it's okay to get drunk, but it's bad to do crack. I mean, there's a craziness here. There's a lack of critical thinking.
It's maybe that lack of identification that alcohol is a drug that,
exactly,
you know, in some circles may lead to that. So we're just about out of time, but if there's one more thing you want to leave people with, those folks, leave them with to think about for FASD, or one thing that you think we should all be doing to deal with this issue.
we need to change the McNaughton rules. These are the rules who determines who's crazy and who's not crazy. Because they're written 150 years ago, they don't work. We need to tune up the criminal code to take care of people who, by brain function, are marginalized and put in jail. And until we fix the criminal code, we're going to fill our jails with people that do stupid crimes, and the jail space should be better spent on stockbrokers and other commercial criminals.
Well, thank you so much for coming down and sharing with us about this issue.
If you're interested, davidbolding.com. There's a bunch of papers there. They're all free. Lots of other websites. Thanks, Emily.
Thank you. We have been speaking with David Bolding. He is a Vancouver lawyer, and he's been working on raising awareness about fetal alcohol spectrum disorder and the law for the past decade. And like David mentioned, for more information about him and his work, you can check out his website. It is davidbolding, BOULDING.com. And another in-depth site you can check out on the issue of FASD and justice and the justice system is one in Ontario. It's fasdjustice.on.ca, very comprehensive site.
Now, I was heartened by the do-it-yourself attitude of David Bolding there, who found FASD was a serious issue, one that was not being addressed, and dedicated himself to trying to raise awareness of that. As a lawyer, of course, he is inside the legal system, and yes, if we have to have prisons, let's fill them with greedy stockbrokers rather than FASD sufferers. But do we have to have prisons? Our next speaker, Baroness Vivian Stern, is asking a rather more fundamental question: what is prison for? Her broader points are amplified by a set of fairly extreme examples, at least I hope they're extreme examples. I haven't spent much time in the UK recently. I'd hoped we could find time this show for something from Angela Davis, whose point is that prison works basically as a dumping ground for anybody who doesn't fit in to the capitalist system, and the threat of prison is used to cudgel people into conformance, into a system with which they otherwise wouldn't be wanting to cooperate. But there wasn't time. So we just have Vivian Stern here. I'm going to finish with Charles Eisenstein's putting Vivian Stern's observed trends about expanding legalism and expanding desire to control what's going on into the larger context of the alienation from the world, from the wild, from the ambiguity, and the desire of those in power to control and regulate everything. Now here's Vivian Stern speaking to the law department at my alma mater, the UK's University of Warwick, in 2008.
She's also honorary president of Penal Reform International, and she, for 20 years, she was secretary general of NACRO, National Association for the Care and Resettlement of Offenders. Since 1999, she has been a crossbench peer and a member of the Parliamentary Joint Committee on Human Rights from 2004-2007. She's also a member of the Advisory Council of the International Legal Center and the Advisory Council of the Legal Policy Research Center in Almaty. In addition to all this, she is a prolific writer. She has written many, many books on prisons, Bricks of Shame, Britain's Prisons, and her latest book is called Creating Criminals, People and Prisons in a Market Society. Barnston.
Thank you very much. Good evening, everybody. I'm very, very happy to be here. This is a very famous and prestigious law school, and it's a privilege to have been invited. And I'm very grateful that so many of you have come to listen to me talking about a subject that inhabits a dark corner of our society and that many people would be happy not to know much about. There's a lot to be said about prisons. I've spent much of my life reading, writing, and thinking about them, and occasionally being in them in all regions of the world. And these have been experiences which show humanity at its worst and sometimes at its best. So I shall try, in the time we have today, to give you an inkling about that experience and to leave you with a question that I think needs answering. The question is, what are prisons for? I saw on your website this statement: the contextual approach has been developed at Warwick for over 25 years. Our aim is to avoid treating law as if it can be separated from other aspects of society. Since it says this on your website about the intellectual environment here, you'll know that the question, what is prison for, is not to be answered so easily with the lawyer's reply, which says, what a simple question. We know what prison is for. It's in all the books. Prison is for the punishment of crime, for retribution, maybe reformation, and the protection of the public. Well, we're going to try and go a bit deeper than that today. And I think I'm going to begin with a story which you might appreciate, something contextual. I want to read you a quote from a letter. The letter says this: I can't last much longer, and I will end up trying to kill myself. This time, I will probably succeed. At least I will be with Nana and Grandad. And that means he will be in heaven. If I could have the chance to be at home with my family, I will never get into trouble again in my life. Anyway, I've got to go now, because I'm too upset to write. This is an extract from the last letter that Adam Rickwood wrote to his mother. He was 14. He was 5'1" tall. He had severe emotional problems. He'd been in hospital 7 times for harming himself. He got into trouble. Eventually, he appeared in court, charged with wounding with intent. He was sent to a children's home to wait for the legal proceedings to take place. It went fine. He settled down very well. His mother bought him a rabbit, which he looked after. Suddenly, he was sent away 150 miles from home to a place called a secure training center. A secure training center is a prison-like place for teenagers as young as 12. Run by a private security company. There are 4 of them, and they're run not by companies that specialize in childcare, but companies, all-purpose companies. They transport cash, they read electricity meters, they also run private prisons for adults. Now, on the night of the 9th of August 2004, there was a little bit of bother at this secure training center. Adam refused to go to his room when they told him to. Then, according to the reports, a first response team was called in. 4 prison staff overpowered Adam and carried him face down to his room. Adam tried to bite one of them, so the man responded with a technique known as, and I quote, a nose distraction. And I just want to alert you to something here. Watch the words. In the prison world, if something is very distasteful, we call it something that's not quite so horrible sounding so that no one will understand. A nose distraction is putting pressure, upward pressure, on the nose to cause pain so that the person feels enough pain to stop doing whatever they're doing. So they hit Adam on the nose. His nose bled. He then flooded his room as a sort of protest. And sometime between 11:45 and midnight, he hanged himself with his shoelaces from a curtain rail. There was an inquest. The man who'd hit him on the nose told the inquest, "There's no way I would hurt a child in our care. That's why I warned him twice. The manual says we're supposed to warn them once, but I did it twice. Little did anyone know, when Adam was sent from the home with the rabbit, he had to leave the rabbit behind, to the privately run children's prison, that this action would lead to so much, that his name would become so well known to lawyers, to judges, to parliamentarians, to policymakers. Little did his mother, who was called Carol Pounder, know, as Adam reached his 14th birthday, that in that year she would lose her son and she would move into a world where she had to speak in public, appear on television, come to the Houses of Parliament, and she'd have her name on a judgment of the High Court of England. How did all that happen to Carol Pounder? Well, this is the course of events. Adam had the distinction of being, as a judge put it, the mournful distinction of being the youngest person ever to die in custody in the United Kingdom. After his death, there was an inquest. At the inquest, it emerged that the use of force to restrain children, with the addition of inflicting pain, was being used to get them to obey orders. It appeared that this was against the rules laid down by the government. According to the rules, force should only have been used to prevent harm or serious damage. How did the coroner at the inquest deal with that? He decided to deal with it by saying, this is an anomaly that needs to be cleared up. It seems they've been using force in this way over several years, and it seems this is in contravention of the rules. Once the coroner had said that and written to the government about it, the government had two choices. One, they could tell the secure training centres, the children's prisons, to keep the rules. They could say, stop using force and stop inflicting pain to get obedience to your instructions. After all, using violence and inflicting pain on people under 18 is quite controversial, and rather against the spirit of the Convention on the Rights of the Child, and has been the subject of very heated debates in Parliament. So that's one thing they could have done. Or, of course, they could change the rules to make it lawful. And I'm not giving any of you a prize if you can guess which they did, because it's too easy. They changed the rules, of course they did. In July 2007, after a heated debate in the House of Lords, they brought in a new statutory instrument to make it lawful for the companies that ran the four private juvenile prisons to use force and inflict pain to maintain good order and discipline. The rule changed caused a bit of an uproar. A case was brought before the Queen's Bench Division that the new rules were unlawful. The court found that what had happened was unsatisfactory in many ways, but allowed the rules to stand. There was an appeal, and eventually the Court of Appeal reversed that judgment. It quashed the rules and said the way they were introduced was unreasonable and they were unlawful because what they permitted was in breach of the European Convention on Human Rights, Article 3, forbidding inhuman and degrading treatment, and Article 8, respect for family life. It therefore became clear that the government was now without any cover. The use of force against the young people to get them to obey orders, which was not allowed by the contracts with the private companies, nor in the rules, was unlawful. The government didn't like that decision, so they tried to appeal to the House of Lords. The request was refused. At last, the road was clear for a judicial review of the decision of the Durham coroner to refuse to allow the jury at Adam's inquest to consider a verdict of unlawful killing. Those representing the family tried very hard to get the coroner to allow the jury to consider the fact that the use of force was clearly unlawful. The coroner wouldn't allow it. The case was decided on the 22nd of January, just 2 weeks ago. The judge, Mr. Justice Blake, ruled that the inquest must be reheard. He said, if a properly directed jury found that there was a contribution to the death caused by Adam's unlawful treatment, that adds urgency and poignancy to the lessons that remain to be learned from the death. Now, you may be wondering, why has she told us that long story? And there are several reasons. First of all, what I want to do is to make it clear that prisons are full of people, real people of all ages. Bad, some of them, sad, maybe, guilty, sometimes not guilty. But all people with names, personalities, mothers, fathers, a wide range of circumstances. And to just describe them as criminals, offenders, or by what they've been convicted of, murderers or arsonists, for example, does not do justice to what we find, the complexity of what we find in the prisons of the world. And that thought, each incarcerated person is an individual, is the basis of Article 10 of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, which defines how the whole world is expected to treat its detained people. All persons deprived of their liberty shall be treated with humanity and with respect for the inherent dignity of the human person. Secondly, I told you the story about Adam Rickwood so that it reminds you that there's a lot of law in prisons. Prisons are places where liberty is taken away and people are completely at the mercy of others for everything, their food, their accommodation, which prison they end up in, near home or 300 miles from home. At the end of the day, they can be dependent on others for life itself. So there's a lot of law to prevent abuses, international human rights law and domestic law, and many opportunities for campaigning lawyers who want to see a more just world to fight for it. And I assume many of you who are law students come into that category. You came into the law to see a more just world, and you will be fighting for better treatment of people like Adam. Another reason why I told you that story, I thought it would be worth at least noting the impact of the arrival of private sector companies into imprisonment. And the interesting situation, when a private sector provider ignores what's in the contract and decides to reinterpret the law so that he can run his institution with the number of staff he has. Because under the costings he put in to get the contract, the staffing levels were low. The judges in both the appeal court and the high court were most unimpressed with the idea that not having enough staff was a very good reason to break the law. This was the case put by the private sector company. And the judgment of the both these judgments are worth reading for that alone. So I wanted you to get a bit of an idea of the implications of contracting out prisons to private companies. Finally, I wanted to tell you about Adam, to give you an idea of how we're using the justice system. The justice system you can see as a great big broom. And once the criminal justice system is allowed to have its way, lots of new laws, lots of more possibilities for punishment. Once it is allowed to operate so widely, It sweeps up many people like Adam and his mother. One of my little achievements in the House of Lords last year, and achievements in the House of Lords are usually very little, was to winkle out of the government how many new imprisonable offences have been created since 1997. I got an answer. Since 1997, they have created 1,036 new imprisonable offences, not just criminal, imprisonable offences in primary legislation, and an additional 446 in regulations. And if you want a reference for that, you'll find it in Written Answers, House of Lords. So I wanted you to have before you an impression of the human beings involved, the policies in place, and the legal framework, before going on to some facts and figures. What are the prisons of the world like? I will summarize and generalize. They are overfull. 110 out of the world's 218 prison systems for which we have information are overcrowded. I have been in rooms with 50 bunk beds, three high, holding more than 150 prisoners. And I tell you, when they open the door of a room like that, you have to stand back so as not to be knocked out by the smell that hits you. But normally, that door is shut and people are living in there. In some places, prisoners sleep standing up, tied to window bars, and people have been known to suffocate because there just wasn't enough air. Prisons can be and often are very violent. In the United States, they have what I think is an astonishing law called the Prison Rape Elimination Act. At least they're honest about it. There's a lot of prison rape to try and eliminate. George Bush actually passed that act. And one can only say, as with prisoners, there is the potential for good in everybody. Talking about violence, I visited the federal prison in Brasilia. We sat in the office of the governor, who was a nice young man, about the age of some of you young people here. Nice young man in a T-shirt. We sat there for a long time. And I began to think they were going to do what sometimes happens. Oh, I'm afraid we can't let this visit go ahead. We've had a call. It's not a good day for a visit. But actually, no. We were sitting there until there appeared eight huge National Guardsmen armed to the teeth with machine guns and grenades. And only then could the governor go into his prison and we could go in too. There are murders in the prisons of Latin America on average every day. Prisons are places where disease is concentrated because of the nature of the people in them, and where disease spreads because of the nature of the living conditions. TB and HIV are widespread. The fact that some drugs are illegal adds hugely to the health hazards in prisons. It's estimated that between one-fifth and one-quarter of the world's prison population is there because of activities connected with the illegality of some drugs. The effect on prison life has been to increase the dangers and the violence. Drug use increases the spread of disease because they share needles. The authorities battle to stop the illegal drugs coming in. They take measures that greatly worsen prisoners' treatment. In some places, prisoners, men and women, have to urinate in front of prison staff to make sure that the samples they use to test for drugs are not falsified. It means that grills are put up between prisoners and family members who visit, so they can't touch or hold their children. There's plenty of ill treatment. And then there are the women in prison. About 1 in 20 of all prisoners are women. They're usually an afterthought in policy terms, housed in buildings designed for men and dealt with by policies devised for men. The women are in prison are, and I generalize only a little, either convicted of very serious crimes, like murdering a husband. And I'll just tell you one little story. I was in a prison in Guatemala with a lot of women, and this grandmotherly lady with very few teeth was being chatted to. And someone said, "What did you do to get in here?" And she went into a great cackle and said, "Ha, I murdered my husband." They're the same women the world over. Last year, I visited a prison in Japan. This prison was a very long way from the main centers of population. So we went there, we went on a bullet train, first of all, and as you know, they go very fast. Then we went onto another train, which went quite slowly. Then we went on another train with just one carriage that went very, very slowly. And then we took a taxi from the station for several miles. The prison was at the end of Yamaguchi Province, a place where economic development was needed. And if I can quote from the briefing we were given, it is an economic enterprise area. They wanted real business, but they got a prison. At least, though, the local government gets the tax income and can count the prisoners as residents for the census, which boosts their grants from central government. The prison, the day we went, was holding 290 women and 261 men. For the women, their main crime was, and I quote here, drug addiction. We met the women. They looked exactly the same, battered, unconfident, depressed women that you can see any day in Holloway Prison in North London. But they had fewer visitors at the far end of Yamaguchi Province. Then there are the minorities. Go to a prison of any country in the world, see who's overrepresented, and you'll know who it is they discriminate against. I was in New Zealand last year, too. Of the prisoners in New Zealand, over half, 51%, are Maori. They make up 14% of New Zealanders. I was in Perth, Western Australia. Aboriginal people in Western Australia are 3%. They make up 40% of the prison population. An Aboriginal elder who opened this conference in Western Australia gave a very nice, very welcoming speech to everyone. But he ended up by saying this: when Western Australia gets an economic boom, which it was just having, what do the Aboriginal people get? We get a nice new prison. And in the United States, at the end of 2007, the black male imprisonment rate was 3,138 for every 100,000 US residents. And the white male imprisonment rate was 481. So I think that's a ratio of 7 to 1. The imprisonment rate for black women was 150, and the white female imprisonment rate was 50, a ratio of 3 to 1. And prisoners everywhere are overwhelmingly poor, undereducated, unemployed, and in ill health. More than half of American prisoners have mental health problems. There are 9.8 million prisoners in the world, or 10.7 million if you count the 850,000 in administrative detention in China, but I'm not going to count them for the moment. That's an increase of 1 million since 2002, but the increase is not happening everywhere. 7 out of 10 countries have had an increase. 3 out of 10 have stayed the same or reduced. 2.3 million of all the prisoners in the world are in the United States. The United States has 5% of the world's population and 24% of the world's prisoners. We usually measure imprisonment rates per 100,000 of the population. The highest imprisoner in the world is the United States, with 756 out of every 100,000. Then there's a big gap